The following is an encore presentation that first aired on September 14th, 2021. This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on September 9th. In February, The Atlantic described how SpaceX has firmly established itself in the town of Boca Chica, which is at the mouth of the Rio Grande. Elon Musk envisions turning this fishing village into a spaceport that will accommodate passengers on starships to destinations as distant as Mars. Understandably, there is some friction between this futuristic endeavor, dominated by rocket scientists, and the residents of this idyllic hamlet. The author notes, instead of an ugly fence, there might be an ugly fence with massive tanks of cryogenic liquid behind it. When residents find papers stuck to their front door, the notes don't ask them to keep the noise down or clean up after their dogs. They warn them that their windows could shatter. And on a different note, in November 2019, the Texas Tribune reported that Governor Abbott designated a five-acre plot of land near U.S. 183 and Montopolis Drive as a temporary living space for homeless persons. They described the property as a large expanse of concrete surrounded by a manufactured home factory and forest, about 5 miles from the state capital. The state then provisioned the property with 10 porta-potties and 5 hand-washing stations. Steve Adler, mayor of Austin, responded by emphasizing the lack of permanent supportive housing and underscored the need for an exit strategy from temporary shelters. His take on the matter? The state's temporary camping area can be constructive when it provides people with a choice that has greater safety, services, and support, and a real prospect of a housing exit. The city will support such efforts with continued focus on permanent housing solutions, and we could really use the state's help here, too. Good evening, and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Gus Bova, staff writer for the Texas Observer. Gus covers homeless issues, the border, labor matters, to name a few of his interests, and he's certainly no stranger to our listeners. His most recent piece is titled The Final Frontera and deals with the impact of Elon Musk's colonization of Boca Chica, Texas. We'll also get an update on Camp Esperanza, the state of Texas property that the governor provided as a homeless camp. We're also joined by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program, is with us too. Thanks for joining us, Gus. Great to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
We've done so many shows with you. I think it was more than a year ago when we talked about labor issues during the pandemic. And I think you're talking about supermarket workers, among others. Later last summer, we did a show on the border. We've done, I think, several on homelessness.
Your most recent article about Boca Chica and SpaceX just came out a few weeks ago. Tell us about it. What was the inspiration for that?
Basically, that's a little corner of Texas, a little corner of South Texas that I've spent time in working on stories about the border wall, also about proposed natural gas developments. The whole SpaceX thing had been on my radar for a while, but it was really recently that events there sort of ratcheted up and became more dramatic and disruptive to the community there. Not to jump ahead too much, but more and more rockets exploding and things like that, things of a dramatic nature. Just to set the scene a little, I'm sure that y'all and any listeners are probably familiar with South Padre Beach. I don't know whether any of y'all have been able to go to Boca Chica Beach, but it's just across the Brownsville Ship Channel. If you were a bird, you'd get there in no time from South Padre. But in a car, you got to go all the way around the channel. It's really something that's totally overlooked by tourists generally. It's really a beach that's utilized by the locals from Brownsville. That's to me what drew me the most and what made me want to do the story was just to emphasize that this is a beach that has for generations been a beach for locals, something of a poor people's beach because it's open 24/7 and is free and there's no development. There's not even a bathroom, you know, there's nothing. But really, I mean, families have used it for a long time. You know, it was the type of place you might go and actually camp out, set up camp for a few days. You know, you could potentially bring some type of a camper out there, a lot of fishermen, a lot of old timers. And basically, SpaceX has been dramatically reducing access to that beach because there's only one road out there and they have to close that road down when they do rocket tests or rocket launches.
How long has this been going on with SpaceX there? I mean, I think we all heard about it in the past few months, but it didn't just start yesterday, did it?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the story starts about a decade ago when Elon Musk, of course, is the founder of SpaceX, the world's second or third richest individual, depending on the day, and Texan nowadays, I suppose. He was looking for a site. So for rocket launches, you need to be next to water, I guess, because rockets sometimes need to fall into a body of water for safety reasons. And you also want to be kind of near the equator because of how fast the Earth spins toward the middle. So basically, that's why the US has been launching from Florida. But he wanted his own private site where he could kind of do whatever he wanted, maybe get away from the prying eyes of some competitors. I've heard that. I'm not sure if that's actually true or not. But anywho, he found this site here in South Texas. And of course, our government officials rushed to give him every gift, incentive, and handout that they could think of in classic Texas fashion. To your question, yeah, things were pretty quiet for quite a while. You know, they chose the site and not a whole lot happened for something like 6-7 years. And then construction just kind of all of a sudden took off. Partially that was because they had to do a lot of sort of work with the ground. The ground was literally not stable enough to support a rocket launch pad.
What's the population of Boca Chica? I mean, it's pretty small, isn't it?
The way that I would put it is the real place to focus in my mind is Brownsville, which is, you know, a city of a few hundred thousand down the road. I mean, it's 20 miles or so away, but people from Brownsville are the ones who use that beach. There is also a small sort of like beach retirement community called Boca Chica Village that is right next to the SpaceX production facility. And SpaceX has managed to buy out most of those people. Some were very unhappy about that whole process, but that is a very small little subdivision.
But the point is, I guess, that having SpaceX move in there, it's been fairly dramatic and has displaced a lot of people and a facility that was fishing and swimming and enjoyed by the locals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess just imagine any sort of public resource or space that you enjoy. And if you normally have 24/7 open access to it, and then all of a sudden it's being shut down at the last minute every few days, or an advisory gets put out that it's going to be shut down and then the advisory is canceled last minute and it's like, oh no, actually it is open, but by then you've already changed your plans for whether or not to go out there. The supposed limit, like how many hours in a year they were supposed to close it down, have just been blown past, just blown through, just ignored in the most cavalier way, which is basically summarizes the whole SpaceX approach to the area. There's federal documents that are involved in the environmental impact assessment process that say SpaceX won't launch rockets during nesting season for these endangered sea turtles and birds in the area. They've acted like that doesn't exist. That time period is basically the whole summer plus a couple months, and they've done tons of launches and tests in that time. Different things about ways that they said they would control the lighting so that it wouldn't disrupt sea turtles. I don't even know if it came through in the story. Like, I just was kind of like, what? Like, it was just amazing that, like, there are these claims, like, we will shield the lighting from reaching the beach. And you can just walk to the beach at night, and it's like having a sports stadium. You know what I mean? It's like a football stadium was there. That's how much light is pouring onto the beach. There's just a real pretty cavalier approach to the area, which makes sense because before he ever moved there, Elon Musk said that there's no one out there. So if rockets blow up, it's cool.
Right. Yeah.
Well, just, you know, it happens a lot, I think. Land near the border is, I guess, devalued or misunderstood by outsiders, you know, because you see it with the border wall and all kinds of different things.
It almost harkens back to the notion of eminent domain, you know, where the state used to come in and sort of take over for various construction jobs, you know, for highways and buildings and whatnot. And now it sounds like that sort of shifted to a corporation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there is some capacity for certain, you know, corporations to use eminent domain under Texas law. SpaceX hasn't had to technically do that. Musk keeps talking about renaming the place Starbase, renaming the area of the beach and where the village was and all that Starbase. I think they have a little restaurant and like sort of bar there now for like, basically for the employees, and they've talked about building a luxury resort, a hotel, all these things, but most of the land is owned by the federal or state government in that area for wildlife refuge purposes. So I don't understand how they intend to pull that off.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a classic conflict brewing there for sure. But even the day-to-day life, you know, for what's left of the villagers there, they're basically, a lot of times they have to go through traffic checkpoints now just to get back to their homes.
Yeah, for the ones who still live in that village right by the production facility, they have to evacuate during certain activities. And it depends on exactly what's going on, but yes, they can also be literally blocked from going just down the road from their own home toward where the beach is. And so, you know, I mean, I kind of just wanted to like make two points, I guess. Like, one, this is like a real area with real existing value to the mostly low-income Latino community there, and that value is being pretty much trampled on. I mean, even if you were going to allow SpaceX to be there, which is obviously happening, there's still numerous ways in which like coexistence could be much more frictionless and more respectful and less disruptive. But then, I mean, to me, the big secondary question was just like, to what end is that community resource being devalued, right? That's when you get into the Mars question. And, you know, I had a lot of fun just talking to some like nerdy professors about like what space colonization would actually do. And it didn't all get into the piece, but I was talking to some professors about potential dystopian sci-fi scenarios, in other words, that might actually really happen. So that got cut because I don't know. But
well, pardon the pun, probably space, if nothing else.
But probably, yes. Ooh, nice. Yes, exactly. but yeah, I mean, watch out because, you know, genetic engineering of people, you know, to adapt to different other planetary environments. And then once you got bug people and turtle people and stuff, interspecies warfare, I can't imagine why the editors cut this. It was great stuff, but.
You made some references to military uses. Much of the space program has become militarized, and maybe it always has been, but when Trump created that base command, I mean, that sort of put the seal on it all, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, in this case, SpaceX at its old Florida facility has already done some sort of spy satellite, I guess, like launching spy satellites into orbit on behalf of whatever military agency or department that would be. And then also the Air Force has interest in using the new big Mars spaceships to potentially deliver payloads. I mean, the article, it was not my scoop there. It was an Ars Technica article. It didn't specify bombs. It didn't say bombs literally, but it just said payloads broadly. And that wouldn't be anything new. Apparently, any of y'all might know more about this than me. This was like very like, I'm not an expert, but I found it interesting that like our own space program when we were trying to go to Mars had the whole connection to the famous Nazi scientist and engineer who ended up being one of the masterminds behind our lunar program. So I don't know, the two are just super overlapping all the time, it seems like.
But even back with the shuttle program, I can remember, you know, those things were launching fairly regularly. Oh, I'm thinking it was the 80s. And there were a couple of those that went up and nobody talked about them, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was just precious little information given out to the press about what they were doing on this particular mission. So, I mean, you fill in the blank, you know?
Yeah, sure. It seems very dispiriting to me to have a billionaire-led Mars exploration versus, but obviously I wasn't even close to being alive in the late 60s when we made it to the moon, but I always assumed that that would have been a lot more sort of inspirational as a national project than what Musk or Bezos is up to.
Well, I was 18 when they reached the moon. I mean, everybody knew it was happening and it was pretty exciting, but you know, it was also doable. And there were, you know, subsequent trips, but geez, I mean, Mars, you know, we've sent these rovers up there and we've learned some things about the planet, but, you know, sending people to Mars is why, first of all, this whole notion of space tourism, even Musk's launch, their most recent one where he had people paying hundreds of thousands of dollars, or was it millions? I can't even remember the figure, but you know, for what?
I think for me, the obvious conflict here is the public interest versus private interest that we've got going on now. Because I mean, for me, when I was a kid and seeing all the space travel, the launches of the shuttle and everything, it just seemed more of something that was in the for the good of the public. And we were all involved. It was run by the government. So it didn't seem at the time that it was like for the benefit of one person. It was, you know, beneficial for all of us. Whereas when we're now proposing that we do this through private corporations, who's the ultimate beneficiary here? Well, it's Musk, is it not? He's the one that's going for the fame and the fortune. Yeah. And kind of just like at the expense of anything that stands in his way. And I didn't feel that way when I was younger and the space program, NASA was, you know, in its heyday and prime.
Jim, you've spent a lot of time on the border. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, you've seen all sorts of things come and go along the border. Just curious if you have any reaction.
Frankly, because it was the area for the community, and I think people spent a lot of time going there, and this has really been sort of usurped by this space project. I'm curious, Gus, if there's any significant opposition going on.
I think it's building. There's more community opposition building ever since the explosions became more common and they started shutting down the road more and more often. I mean, there's no real support from local officials for that opposition. You know, I mean, local officials are still very much ingratiating themselves with Musk. Brownsville mayor is posing for photo op. And again, he got all the economic incentives you can give him, basically. Plus the authority to close down the beach in the first place, because Texas actually has a law against that, you know, one of the best laws in the nation for protecting public beaches. So we had to pass an exception. But I guess what I'm saying is that I feel like it's there and growing, but it's also kind of late. Like there was a lot of years where there just wasn't much vocal opposition is my read on it. And I don't know if it's too late now. I mean, at minimum, SpaceX, in my view, could be a better neighbor than they're being now, even if it's too late to actually like undo the whole project.
I'm curious, what's the reaction been to your story?
Good comments. I thought I was going to get flooded. In particular on Twitter, I thought I was going to get flooded by Elon Musk fanboys or fan people, but they haven't really found me yet. So I don't know. Maybe maybe the article was too subtle in the headline or something. Because yeah. I've seen other people online get swarmed.
Yeah. Did you meet any particularly interesting characters while you were covering this?
I mean, the big thing for me was just to spend time just talking to random people on the beach, mm-hmm. as opposed to the established environmental advocates down there that I knew, of course, were going to be opposed it and have opposed it all along and have been trying to find sort of an audience and trying to build support for their position instead of just being a handful of people. And what I found was that just walking along the beach, by just talking to the people who by default are the community that uses the beach, I mean, I don't know, it wasn't a scientific poll or anything, but a solid majority were very critical of or opposed to SpaceX. Just a couple were actually positive about SpaceX. And it was like little scenes, like the one I ended the story with, where it's just like a real nice, like guy named Henry. That's just like, I just remember he's like standing in like the surf and he's just this like skinny guy with a little newborn grandson in his arms, you know? And he kind of like talked like a, kind of like a hippie way of talking, you know? And he was just like, it's all ambition, man. That's all this is, you know? And I was like, okay, this guy's cool. I like him. And he had like six family members there and they were just grilling chicken and, you know, and it's all these families, people whipping up, you know, micheladas and stuff. And there was one Republican guy that didn't make it into the story in the end, but he was sitting there on the bed of his F-150 with a big come and take it flag with the gun waving in the wind, big old michelada in his hand. And he was super fed up with SpaceX. He had a lot of stuff to say, like we were here way before him. And also the jobs that he brings, they're not going to go to the people that I went to school with here in Brownsville. They're not going to go to us who are actually from here. You know, the people are going to come from elsewhere to do the jobs, which is what happens a lot. There's just a lot of good little interactions like that. Plus there are some really dedicated environmental activists down there that I've spoken to for a number of stories that I really enjoy talking to as well. But I tried to focus on just the random people on the beach.
Yeah. Speaking of the environmental activists, that's one thing that I was wondering, like, you know, it seems like ripe for protests from some more engaged groups that may be more nationally based or at least Texas based. Are some of the people that you talk to about that affiliated with any groups that, you know, have some backing behind them?
I haven't seen anything in a big way. Like, I mean, we're talking like kind of obscure groups here, like the Surf Rider Foundation, which like advocates on behalf of surfers, you know? There's like a Coastal Bend Bird Sanctuary group of like scientists that's very involved. And they have their own little chapter of the Sierra Club down there that's very active on all kinds of stuff, but I'm not always 100% sure how connected they are to like the resources of the National Sierra Club. I wonder if Musk supports the National Sierra Club. He might, I don't know. Maybe one related point would be just to mention that there is a potential turning point that I didn't go into a ton of detail on, but there is the possibility that the Federal Aviation Administration would require a new environmental impact statement because of how much the project has changed over the last 7 years. And that would be a pretty major obstacle for SpaceX if they were to do that. And I'll tell you, like, this stuff doesn't get out there very much, but like Texas Parks and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, like these bureaucrats, they have written many very strongly worded letters about SpaceX as a part of this process. They just don't broadcast it as like they don't put out a press release, you know? But if you go to these letters, I'll tell you, there's also a lot of sort of like well-meaning bureaucrats, I guess, who are pretty pissed off.
And with good reason, you know, I mean, they've got to be wreaking some havoc on the environment there. When you just think about the combustibles that they're using and the amount of noise that they're generating. And
they've started these wildfires in that sort of special thorn scrubby South Texas habitat there, but also right on the coast there. That's like, there's certain species that just love that. And they've started wildfires and then not reported to the proper agency in a timely fashion, things like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, at the very least, an interesting story and with some tragic overtones for sure, but it's definitely in progress at this point. We do hope that you keep your eyes open on that one, Gus, and let us know what develops.
Yeah.
You know, just a few weeks before you filed that story, you did another story on homelessness. You've done several for the Texas Observer, and this one was titled Life and Death in a Texas Homeless Camp. And it focuses on what is now generally called Camp Esperanza. Could you refresh for us the history of Camp Esperanza?
Yeah, so this is the camp in Southeast Austin. It's right off 183, basically in the Montopolis neighborhood over there, that in 2019, when the governor and Austin City Council were really actively feuding over homeless camping policies, as y'all will recall, the governor did something a bit surprising, which was at the same time that he was ordering the state highway department to clean out camps beneath highways, he also opened up this plot of state-owned land in Southeast Austin for camping. Generally, that's called creating a sanctioned campsite. That's kind of the term of art, a sanctioned encampment. I don't think it's necessarily a liberal or conservative policy idea, but pre-COVID, it really only happened on the West Coast, where you would actually legally designate, okay, this is a legal homeless campground.
And when we think about campgrounds, you know, those of us who have gone camping think about wildlife and greenery and lakes and mountains and things. Was that what Camp Esperanza was like when the governor dedicated it to this purpose?
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, it was not. It was a 7-acre paved lot with some sort of half dilapidated old garages that were used for vehicle maintenance by the state. And that was about it. No trees to provide shade or break the wind to speak of. It's pretty bleak. Definitely the feeling you got when you went out there was bleakness.
This is an encore presentation that first aired on September 14th, 2021. Our guest this evening is Gus Bova, staff writer for the Texas Observer. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. We continue with an encore presentation that first aired on September 14th, 2021. The segment with Austin Sanders toward the end of the hour is new and was recorded on Friday, April 8th. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Gus Bova, staff writer for the Texas Observer. We're discussing the homeless shelter established by Governor Abbott in 2019 on a highway maintenance site in Southeast Austin. Let's pick up where we left off.
You know, I've never heard this referred to as Camp Esperanza. Where's that coming from?
The residents actually, with the help of the Other Ones Foundation, the nonprofit that's out there now, the residents actually renamed it to the Esperanza Community. And that was late last year. So before that, I was calling it Abbottville. Briefly, some people called it Camp Rat, which was an odd name.
I've most often heard it referred to as Abbott's Camp.
Yeah, for sure.
Jim, your offices were right over there, weren't they?
Yeah, pretty close. And I've been to the camp a number of times. It's pretty dismal. Should we change it to Desesperanza?
I think it's somewhat interesting, Jim, like maybe it's obvious, but the fact that a big camp would go near that neighborhood, I think says something, you know, sort of a working class Latino neighborhood rather than somewhere on the west side or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I think it's called racism.
That's the technical term.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, you know, it's crazy. It looked like it was an old state parking garage mm-hmm. that they didn't know what to do with.
They used to actually do vehicle maintenance. And then more recently, apparently it was just like storing like road signs. So it wasn't being used for much, but all the objections that get raised to affordable housing or homeless camps in other neighborhoods definitely apply there because it is right near a school. And anyone who lives there in that area probably knows that it's connected by trails through the woods behind there. So it might seem separate from the neighborhood, but it's not. It's connected by foot trails right back there, which it needs to be because that's how the residents are able to walk to the corner store and stuff. But it's an interesting place. There's kind of a tangent I went on. There's a sort of half hidden old Freedman Cemetery right behind it too, sort of overgrown.
You've definitely followed a few people through your story. Tell us a little about them.
Yeah, that was what I decided to do with that one mostly was more than anything, just try to tell a couple people's stories. The main person, a guy named Teddy, who's just one of those people that you're really lucky to meet who, for whatever reason, is completely open about everything that's ever happened in their life. And, you know, I checked with him and checked with him and he didn't mind. And even he liked the idea of his story being told. So I was able to go into a lot of detail and show a lot of things like kind of show how getting out of prison leads to homelessness so often as it did with him. And it's just such a common phenomenon, but you're destabilized. You're sort of put into a weird kind of homelessness by being in prison. You get out and you get put into weird halfway houses with weird rules or this, that, and the other. It's just this moment of instability and tons of people become homeless then. He's weird, but not that weird in that he maintained a full-time job while living on the street, which I wouldn't say that that's like a majority, but it's more common than you might think. You know, he held down a full-time job while paying child support that had accumulated in prison while living on the street before he found this camp. And I just thought his story touched on a bunch of different aspects of homeless life, you know, and he was just a compelling guy. He's a funny guy, you know, very resilient. And
there were some other people, though, that even Teddy had some tragic episodes in his life that you related. He had some substance abuse in there at some point.
I wanted to mention that in that story. So in general, in most of my stories about homelessness and homeless camps, I have not talked about drugs very much because there is this myth out there that drug and alcohol abuse is what causes homelessness in some significant or systemic way, which is just not true. However, anyone who spent a significant amount of time in a homeless camp, I mean, it's right in front of your eyes. The needles are there. People talk about it all the time. I just wanted to actually, rather than sort of leave it out for fear of feeding into the right-wing myth, I just wanted to put it in there and then explain sort of what happens, that there's a lot of stuff about life on the streets that actually makes certain drugs make a lot more sense as a coping mechanism.
Well, the camp itself, we emphasized what a bleak place it was. And then this foundation, the Other Ones, came along. It's a fairly recent group. And it sounds like they're trying to make the place livable. Tell us about what they've done.
They're a fairly new nonprofit on the scene, but they sort of have built a rep for themselves as a sort of scrappy organization, getting involved in things that maybe other organizations don't want to get involved in, or, you know, a certain DIY can-do type of attitude. That's kind of their whole vibe. Their name is like a Grateful Dead reference. I think they have a band. Like, I think the nonprofit, I think the staff has a band. Yeah, they're kind of going for that Austin vibe. And they do a good job, I think, of hiring formerly or even currently unhoused people. Basically, because of the way that that camp was started, there just wasn't much appetite on the part of the nonprofits to take over responsibility mm-hmm. for the site. So for months, there was no real central group coordinating it, unless you want to say the state was doing it, but they weren't doing a terribly good job. Basically, eventually during COVID, they just decided you know what, screw it. We're going to move our headquarters from South Austin to the camp and see what we can do here. And I think the way I put it in the story was that, you know, they managed to sort of soften some of the sharper edges out there. Once they were there, they were able to get more, you know, either doctors or different types of medical professionals out there to see people, able to make like food and water more of a consistent, predictable thing, provide case management as much as possible, though it takes a lot of case management for 200 people. I mean, it's just real like Wild West, maybe sort of edge of civilization type stuff. Just so many dogs being born out there and not ever being fixed and just biting the residents all the time. Stuff like that, man. Like, it makes you realize how nice it is to have like a sort of functioning city government that you're a part of.
Yeah.
They came in to kind of take the sharper edges off that. They have a long-term plan that's going to cost millions of dollars to transform the place into something that will be a little bit more like community first, if you all know what that is, but still temporary, not permanent housing.
Aren't they establishing like tiny houses out there?
They're technically different than like those nice, the community first ones. A lot of them are, they're meant to be permanent and they're like nice. And even like some of them are really like artistic and different people designed them, different architects and stuff, you know. These are going to be more like cookie cutter, sort of like standard micro shelters is that they, what they call them. But yeah, that's a multi-million dollar project, going to take a while. And I'm really interested to see just how it works. You know, I mean, what are the rules going to be? Okay. What are you going to do about the small number of residents that are, you know, basically committing repeat theft or domestic violence and things like that, and making it unsafe for other residents, right? You know, these are all unhoused people, but there's lots of differences within the community. And you're coming in trying to set up this functional community structure. How, what are you going to do? Because you don't want to send people to prison. That's a huge challenge in my view.
Yeah. The other ones, I mean, do they now have a contract with the state, or did they just sort of step in there and the state and the city have basically said, well, go ahead, have at it?
They finally got a lease recently. So
So it was both. They did just move in there and now they've sort of formalized it, I guess is what you're saying, huh?
Yeah, they were there without a lease for a year, I guess.
It's like so much with homelessness, you know, I mean, everything is very ad hoc, you know, and what do we need to make this work?
Are they working with other community agencies here in Austin, though, to kind of help make certain things happen?
Yeah, for sure. Mobile Loaves and Fishes is out there all the time with their food program and also just collaborating on getting people moved from there into Community First. I can't remember all the names of all the organizations sometimes, but like the different nonprofits or city agencies that do like mental health stuff and different health programs, they're out there now. It's just, until recently, there was not one, or there's no one who wanted to bottom line the thing. You know what I'm saying? So people kind of came and went, got involved and then left.
But 200, the January count is several thousand, right? So this is less than 10% of the street population, you know, the people living on the streets. So it's a small effort, yet a significant one. And I don't want to take anything away from the other ones foundation that sound like they've taken an impossible situation and at least trying to make it livable. But the problem is, I don't want our listeners to think that this is it for homeless people. This is their only option, is to go out there to Camp Desesperanza, as Jim would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I'd be curious to know what y'all are seeing in your neighborhoods or on your commutes or anything, because from what I can tell, the city really is picking up the pace on clearing camps now in the last few weeks or so.
Not fast enough for Save Austin now, but
yeah. I live pretty close over to the 7th and Pleasant Valley area, and there was a big camp under that bridge that they just cleared out recently. And so, yeah, I mean, the camps are getting cleared. I mean, I plan to go out later and just kind of track where people went.
Yeah, I still see lots of tents. I'm up in Burnett, 183 area, and there's still people camping under the underpasses and along the embankments and stuff up here. Some of it's gotten cleared, but sporadically here and there, I still see them. So I've been wondering about that. Like, is the city enforcing this or are they kind of laying low?
Yeah, there was that whole phased approach after Prop B in May. And Austin Sanders reported on the time when they cleared out an encampment in front of City Hall a couple months ago.
Yeah, no, that was kind of disturbing. But I was out of town when it happened, and there were a couple of arrests, right? Isn't that what his reporting showed, I think?
And exactly, yeah. And
that was a protest camp, you know, and they seemed to sort of just decide that that one had to go, and it wasn't really a part of the whole phased approach or the policy they announced. They just all of a sudden said this had to go, and they said it was because of like planned construction, but yeah. I don't know about that.
The whole way that it was announced, for some reason, the adjective devious comes to mind, but you know, they didn't announce it till like Saturday morning, and they were going in there at 7 a.m. on Monday.
Yeah.
And as you say, there were some arrests associated with it too. But aside from that, my impression is that this phased approach, they've tried to do this as humanely as possible. The fact that Save Austin now is suing the city, I think, is a feather in the city's cap. To me, says that they must have been trying to be somewhat compassionate in what they were doing.
All I know for sure right now is just that they had the one track where they were doing certain campsites, and the people there would actually be given an offer of a shelter bed or housing. Mm-hmm. And they have now moved past that so that camps are just being cleared with no particular offer of anything. Unless there's some new magic solution that I'm not thinking of, I have to assume people are going back to the wooded areas and the watersheds and the creek bed where they were before. A few people, you know, will probably get into a hotel for a couple nights and then be back out. Maybe a few people will go back to some family arrangement that'll last for however long, but not long term. And there's so much instability and back and forth and people who are in this situation, right? But I think a significant amount are just going to go back to the hidden areas. I mean, what else would they do?
But, you know, when they come in and basically bust up a campsite, I don't know what they do when they bust it up. Do they take people's possessions? Do they carry off their tents? I don't know. But they're certainly not offering them an alternative. Imagine yourself, you've been living there for several months, and now they're telling you to get out of there. You know, where do you go?
I don't want to say we're right back where we started. I know that the mayor, and of course he has to say this, but I think that there's maybe something legitimate to his point that all the extra attention over this time means that more resources are going toward the problem than before. That seems to be true. Part of that's because of federal COVID dollars, right? So I guess there's that. But in other ways, start to feel like a broken record or something at some point, you know?
Yeah. We've been here before, that's for sure. I just have one other comment. I noticed that both of those articles, when you look them up online, they have white print on black background. Is there an implied common thread between the two stories?
You give me a great opportunity to pitch our new Texas Observer website redesign. If you haven't seen it yet, texasobserver.org, totally redesigned. You can toggle, there's actually a button that you can switch it. You can make it black on white or white on black. Our art director will be happy that I was able to make this pitch. It's not your grandpa's Texas Observer anymore. It's a stylish magazine now.
No, I did see that, though. It's not your grandpa's Texas Observer anymore.
So, okay, Grandpa.
Yeah, man, it was like sort of a sad feeling.
There are people in the community I think wish we still had. We should have never gone glossy, you know, but
I like it. I think it looks pretty good.
Well, really appreciate the update on the homeless story. Very personal piece. I was quite moved. I was actually tearing up a couple times as I read the thing. And you're telling people stories that would not otherwise be told, Gus. So on their behalf, thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank y'all for having me. And Jim, I promise that I'm personally still scrappy and poorly dressed and a secret leftist agitator and all the rest.
Okay, I'm going to hold you accountable.
Okay.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, April 8th, and once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Happy Friday, Austin.
Yeah, happy Friday indeed. It's a lovely day out.
So council met yesterday, and among other things, they considered this matter of the fuel farm at the airport. I didn't know we were even growing fuels there, you know?
Right, yeah. Part of our general growth. Got to grow enough fuel.
What was the controversy there?
So basically, the Austin Bergstrom International Airport, the officials there say we need to be able to store more jet fuel. We're having more and more passengers come through our airport every day. The director of the airport told council last week at their work session that when they approved the airport's master plan, which kind of outlined growth through 2040, they were anticipating about 4% increase in passenger volume per year. It's been about 8% since they approved that plan. So just a lot of growth. They want to be able to store more fuel, I guess about 6 million gallons worth in total over about the next 15 or 20 years in jet fuel that airliners can use to refuel. Obviously flights into Austin, but also flights that maybe route through Austin, right? If there's more capacity to fuel up for airliners in Austin, they're more likely to bring in more flights into our airport, right? The airport studied 12 sites last year and into this year and deemed that where they want to put these new fuel tanks, which is on the airport property, but it's also near residential homes, right? Homes that have been there for years. But the airport says this is the best place. Obviously, people living nearby are very concerned about living near millions of gallons of jet fuel. The fears range from seeping into the soil and affecting the water supply, things of that nature, to the catastrophe of a fire or explosion that breaks out. And of course, the airport says those concerns are understandable, but highly unlikely, right? You know, they've gone through an extensive federal review process to make sure that the environmental safety is there, that safety measures take into account to prevent the kind of catastrophes that could happen, small or large. They note that there had never been any kind of catastrophe of that kind at the current fuel farm where they're storing their jet fuel. But for people in East Austin, they'll think back to the 90s when the jet fuel farm for the old airport, right, which is now the Miller Plan development, did cause harm to the community that lived by, that resulted in cancer for people living nearby from breathing in those fumes and things of that nature. That farm was relocated in 1992 because of environmental activists, you know, really pressuring the city to do so. Again, the airport says, you know, it's not really a fair comparison. There are just so much more safety measures in place, more extensive review gone into place for this proposed expansion of the tank farm at the airport. And so those fears, again, while understandable, are very unlikely to come to reality.
This is Fuentes District, right?
Yes, Vanessa Fuentes, representing Council District 2. And she's really been leading the opposition to relocating the tank farm here. She's been really engaged with her constituents, working with the airport, really on top of this issue. And so where we started this conversation off at the council meeting last week, Councilmember Fuentes brought a resolution which basically would halt the expansion of the tank farm plans, require that the airport and city staff identify at least three alternative locations to store the fuel, engage in a renewed community engagement effort to kind of inform nearby residents of what could come, conduct a new environmental review at the local level in addition to the federal review. But what actually happened at the council meeting is that resolution failed because she could only get 5 votes in support of it. The final vote was 5 council members for it, 5 against it. You need at least 6 votes to pass any measure at council for most measures. So 5, it fails, right? There's no tie-breaking vote the way that, you know, the U.S. Senate has a tie-breaking vote. So the resolution actually failed. Effectively, what that means is the airport can proceed with their expansion of the tank farm as they originally intended. They've agreed as a compromise. Mayor Adler proposed a range of things, one of which would be establishing what he called the airport green team, which would be composed of community volunteers, airport staff, other environmental experts to kind of play a part in the expansion of the airport over the next 20 years or so, right? Again, this is just one phase of a broader expansion plan of the airport to accommodate more travelers moving through it. So this airport green team would kind of work with the community, city hall staff, council offices, airport staff to kind of guide that process from an environmental justice perspective going forward.
They sure do have their hands full out at the airport. I mean, besides this issue, you know, we've been seeing lines go out the door.
Right. That's kind of what I alluded to in the story that I wrote previewing this. You know, the fight against the tank farm has been going on since the beginning of the year, at least when the site was identified, and had been gaining steam. But then toward the end of March, we had these headlines about, you know, how terribly long some of the waits are for security and, you know, and flights at the airport. Those are not really related to fuel storage, but they could become related, right? You know, the problems we're seeing now are basically from TSA being understaffed and not having enough people to process through security. But you can imagine a scenario where you have that problem in addition to a fuel shortage, which would reduce the amount of flights, and then you've got a compounded problem. So I think for sure, those headlines from the end of March were certainly on the minds of council members as they considered this vote last week.
You know, putting on my environmental goggles, forgetting about the safety issue, which I sense this is mostly about with people being concerned about this thing blowing up. But it's just interesting to me, all the energy that we've focused on climate change and reducing fossil fuels, that this issue and what's going on in Europe right now, it just seems like every time we hit a crisis, all we can think about is expanding fossil fuels, you know?
Right. And you've hit on a really good point that this is kind of a really vexing situation for the city, which, as we've talked about previously, last year they adopted this climate equity plan, right? Which is meant to guide the city toward net zero carbon usage over the next 20, 30 years. Expanding the airport is obviously in direct contradiction to those efforts, right? Because airliners are some of the biggest consumers of fossil fuels, but we're one of the fastest growing cities in the nation, and we're going to have people flying into Austin, and we need to be able to manage that growth responsibly in a number of ways, one of which includes at the airport. So you have some people thinking about how can the city offset the increased carbon usage from increased travel at the airport in other ways. But yeah, you're absolutely right that it's a difficult situation that the city is in, needing to expand the airport while committing to reducing carbon emissions.
Well, in addition to that story, I noticed you've been covering integral care. Maybe you could remind our listeners what integral care is about.
Yeah, Integral Care, it's a healthcare provider, a governmental entity that operates in Austin, Travis County. They provide mental health and, you know, physical health care to people in Austin, mostly to those who can't afford private providers. They work a lot in homelessness and housing and things of that nature. So they're a really important player in efforts to kind of reduce homelessness and help people struggling with mental health issues. And for the past year, employees at that agency have been trying to unionize the workforce. They've talked about really difficult working conditions before the pandemic, which they attribute to mismanagement at the agency, ineffective leadership, but that have just really been exasperated by the pandemic, right? These are frontline clinical care, behavioral health positions we're talking about, which that industry just overall nationwide has been really struggling. And so they expect at the end of this month, when Integral Care's Board of Trustees meets again, they will vote on what's called a consultation policy, which will basically authorize a union. And then in the background, union organizers have been working with employees to collect signatures that basically say, I want to join the union. They have a certain threshold to hit, and they suspect that they're well beyond it. So basically, once the Board of Trustees takes this vote to approve the consultation policy, the union will spring into existence. And employees say this will help them earn better pay and benefits, safer working conditions, just generally give employees more of a voice in policymaking decisions that affect the agency, and of course, that affect patients and clients that these employees are working with.
Who'd have ever thought that Texas may someday be known as a union state?
They're growing, right? We have a couple of Starbucks, right? Two or three in Texas, unionizing, other private businesses. Yeah, so it's certainly gaining some steam, even if unions in Texas are limited in what they're allowed to do in terms of striking and collective bargaining.
Well, as always, we appreciate your updating us on what's going on at City Council and in other areas of the city. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Well, that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone. Up next is the Austin Local Music Mix on co-op.org and on the HD3 channel.